Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm delighted to welcome actor, comedian and broadcaster Sanjeev Bhaskar.
Hello.
Hello.
God, I didn't recognise myself in your introduction.
And I can't think of anybody more qualified at the moment because you are officially in a Beatles movie.
Well, Beatles associated, I suppose. Yesterday was released at the end of June. And yeah, what a thrill to be a part of it.
Wow. How were you approached? Did they know you were a Beatles fan?
I'm not sure if they did. I mean, I'd known Richard Curtis, who wrote it, for some time, being involved with Comic Relief. And the first little bit in a film I ever did was in Notting Hill. So, and I remember dinner at Richard's place, God, 15 years ago probably, where we ended up talking about the Beatles. And so I knew he was a big Beatles fan. I'm not sure if he still remembered I was, but I auditioned. I auditioned for the film. Wow. And so Richard and Danny Boyle, who directed it, were in the audition. And I came in and then just blurted my love of the Beatles at them for a while. But it was, it's a strange thing. I mean, it's a light-hearted, romantic, comedy, feel-good movie with, you know, just the best sort of back catalogue of songs to choose from. So I was in seventh heaven with it, really. Anything that was mildly annoying was that I had to feign no interest in the bit. They've not come for me.
This is the geek police.
They've not come for me. Here. I know. We're in a bunker. We're all right. I wasn't allowed to join in with any of the songs, and I had to kind of. But it's very difficult not to.
Yeah, because you were given this amazing Sergeant Pepper Photoshop thing at the end of the film.
It was just the loveliest gift. Actually, I mean, it's a mock-up of the Sgt. Pepper album cover, and with a lot of the original characters on the album cover still there, but also some of them replaced by those in the film. Mm. So that was a lovely thing to get.
Yeah.
It's utterly gorgeous. Unique.
It is beautiful. So the Beatles, how did the Beatles first come into your world? How old were you? What did they mean to you?
I think it was about three or four, actually, and my mum has a picture of me at about that age, about three, maybe two and a half, actually, of me holding a guitar, which is so big that I'm holding it like a sort of bass guitar, a double bass. Yeah. And I asked my mum when I was older. I said, "Well, you know, where was that taken, and what were the circumstances?" And she said, "Well, you were singing 'She Loves You,' along with the no doubt strumming the guitar in a terrible way." But so very, very early on, from 3 or 4 years old. And I remember our neighbours in West London had a chip shop, and their son had, he had a sort of Beatles haircut, which I think a lot of young men did at the time, sort of mopped up. But they then gave me as a present a little kind of Beatles branded guitar, which was about, I don't know, a foot long, a little kid's guitar thing, which had a picture of the Beatles on there. So I know that it was very, very early on. Yeah. So certainly, you know, before the age of five or six.
Yeah. And the album you've picked is Help.
Hmm.
What are your feelings? When did you first hear this album?
I'm not sure. I probably heard the album when I was a lot older, actually. But, I mean, songs from it I'd heard a lot earlier. And I think it's a really interesting album. I don't think it's their best album by a long way. It's not, you know, one of my favourite albums either. But I think it's a really important album because I think it's the album that most charts the change. I think this is the transition album from, you know, the Beatles for Sale and the early poppy stuff, the clearly poppy stuff, into them getting more and more experimental. So I think after this came a Rubber Soul and then Revolver. So this one, even though it's ostensibly linked with the film and a lot of the songs were written with the film in mind, as was kind of customary with the couple of films that they made, particularly when it was an LP, one side were songs from the film and the other side were kind of other songs that they they added. And so in that sense, I think it's a really, really interesting album for lots of different reasons.
Yeah. And as you say, yeah, same format as Hard Day's Night, wasn't it? So side one, all tracks from the film.
Mm.
I watched the film yesterday for the first time in a long time. And
no, you can't say I saw the film yesterday now, because that just means the film
no,
I see.
No. What?
Just say I saw Help recently or something, because otherwise I'm just going to get really confused.
I know. Yeah. Hang on, that's going to be a problem. Can I order a ticket yesterday? No. Anyway. I watched the film Help yesterday for the first time. I did it again.
No, that's fine. It worked that way around. I wasn't confused. It's when you said I saw the film yesterday. That's what confused me momentarily. Not very confused. I've been more confused in
my
life.
I'm going to watch it tomorrow. I want to do this. I watched the film Help the other day.
Very good.
And, yeah, my memories of it, I remember it being a wacky, zany film. It's a bit problematic now, isn't it, these days, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly of its time, but, I mean, it's just not a very good film. And I kind of, you know, I'm a big Elvis fan as well, and so I've kind of watched all of the Elvis films. And, you know, some of the Elvis films, you know, got really, really terrible. Yeah. And this is kind of up there with, as a film, as one of the terrible Elvis films as well. Except for the music and the music moments in it, which are phenomenal. I mean, they're just brilliant and shot really well, you know. And so it's kind of interesting in that sense that the film itself, which is loosely based around an idea where some kind of vaguely Indian Eastern cult thing are chasing a sacrificial ring that Ringo has somehow got onto his finger, and we don't know how, other than he says a girl just gave it to him, a fan gave it to him. And for some inexplicable reason, the ring won't come off.
No.
And so therefore they're chasing him to be the kind of sacrificial victim. You know, if that was the only thing that was a bit weird about it, it would be fine. But then they add a couple of characters who are scientists who are prepared to kill Ringo for this ring as well. Yeah. And so it just descends into, such a confusing mess that it's actually, as a film, quite difficult to watch. It's got really lovely moments in it, but it's lots of fake Indian accents, and it's, this weird. And what's weird to me is also this kind of predates by, a couple of years, the Beatles' interest in India and going to Rishikesh and recording the White Album. So I don't know if this drove them towards it, or maybe kind of thought, this can't be the Indian mystical philosophical thing, can it?
Yeah, you have to be doused in red paint before you can be sacrificed, apparently, according to this cult.
Yes, because, it's another hilarious moment to throw red paint at somebody. And and it's got some really good people in it. And but it's still kind of Leo McKern, who I guess was most well-known for Rumpole of the Bailey in Britain. Plays the main kind of swami in it. And Eleanor Bron, who I always had a crush on, is in there as kind of one of the, another person with a fake Indian accent. Most of the people in it have fake Indian accents. Yeah. I mean, I think even Warren Mitchell appears in one momentary scene as well, without a fake accent.
No.
But nevertheless, it's a strange thing. And, there's a tiger that, let loose at one point that traps Ringo in a basement of a pub. I mean, it's just really, it really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I think it's quite archetypal of the Richard Lester movies, though. They are a bit all frenetic and all over the place, aren't they? And I guess they had more money here. So, yeah, let's fly off to the Bahamas and film some stuff there. I don't think there was much
Bahamas,
more.
Bahamas, Austria, and, bits of London. But I think everything that was good about and fresh about A Hard Day's Night was kind of lost here. And I think one of the reasons was this was only made a year later. And I think it was rushed, and it feels really rushed as a film. The album is another matter, but the film certainly is. Things can be of its time, and I don't object now to a 1965 film which has people doing fake Indian accents. But the it's the logic, the structure, and the handling of the film, I think, which is most problematic.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. And now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind, I've opened up a door.
Moving on to the album,
yeah,
which is a far more enjoyable experience.
It is.
Similar to Hard Day's Night soundtrack, the first note of this album, this huge crash, help, what an opener.
It's extraordinary. I mean, the song, you know, and I've kind of read since that John Lennon, you know, wrote it as a genuine cry from the heart, reflecting where he was at that time, and instead it became the title of the film. And as you say, that opening kind of sort of burst of energy, this small kind of nuclear explosion going off is a phenomenal start to the song. But also, I think the song is really interesting in that it's only when I kind of thought about it, because you take these things for granted after a while, but, you know, the fact that the backing singers, Paul and George in this, preempt the lines is really interesting. I mean, it's such an interesting thing to do. And melodically, it's great, as so much of their output was. But once you know it's a genuine cry for help as well, you feel, maybe it's projection, you sense that in John's lead vocals in it. There is a kind of straining. It's not a happy thing. And one of the interesting things I think about this album, actually, given that it was tied in with this zany knockabout film, is just quite how melancholic a lot of the songs are. There's a kind of melancholic streak to the album in many ways. It's a few songs that are quite upbeat, but most of it is kind of, and that's why I do feel it is that transitionary album as well, stylistically as well. But yeah, Help is still phenomenal.
Yeah, there were two singles that appeared on the album, Ticket to Ride and Help. But similar, the B-side of Help, I'm Down, it's kind of the same structure. It's a very upbeat song, but lyrically he's talking about, you know, my relationship's breaking up, I'm down. But it was I'm down.
In a way, that's kind of interesting about the songs on the album anyway, is that that sort of melancholic streak kind of counterpoints the upbeat energy of the songs, and I find that really interesting. I think originally, again, I read that John had written Help as a much more of a ballad, a slow piano ballad.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'd be interesting to hear that, but I can't imagine it'd have the impact that, you know, the finished version does have. But yeah, I mean, I'm Down, Help. It's pretty clear as a message, isn't it, really? It's not particularly ambiguous.
No. Slightly geeky here, but the slightly different version to the single version on the album. The way he sings, now I find I change my mind, on the single, on the album he sings, now I find I change my mind.
Okay.
Geek alert.
Yeah.
Listen for the sirens.
They're on silent. They put it on silent. They didn't catch you unawares.
Track two, The Night Before.
Yeah. No, I really like this. I mean, it's, you know, it's more akin to, for me, their previous kind of poppy stuff. But this is kind of McCartney, really, kind of adding in a lightness of touch in amongst all the kind of, you know, the downbeat sentiments that John brings, and I guess always brought. So I really like it. I mean, it's, I find the vocals really interesting. I find that the arrangement's really good fun. And it's, as I said, it kind of, for me, it belongs to, you know, the earlier output of the Beatles. And so therefore, yeah, I really like the song.
And they're augmenting themselves with slightly different instruments. You've got John on the electric piano on this one. This is also recording at the same time as You Like Me Too Much, which has got the same organ on.
Right.
In the same session. So it's almost like they, yeah, we've not used this instrument. We're doing these two songs during the session. Why not?
Well, they had, I mean, I think they used more kind of piano and keyboards on this album than on any previous one, with them playing, as opposed to, you know, George Martin playing a little bit or playing a harpsichord or something. So I think they did certainly use more pianos in this than they had done before. Yeah, I didn't know that You Like Me Too Much and Night Before were recorded in the same session.
Yeah.
It's kind of,
Here I stand, head in hand, turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on, feeling 2 foot small. Track 3, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. We can smell Bob Dylan in the...
You can, can't you? It's much more folky, and I think if I think I might be right in saying that I think this was the first acoustic song that they'd all done, and had brought in an outside musician, and I don't know his name, the guy who plays the flute in it.
Johnny Scott.
Yeah. But yeah, the kind of Dylan influence, and again, as a kind of indicator of them preempting the experimentation they were going to go on. They'd moved away from, still a pop song, but the it wasn't, you know, the blues rock and roll background that they'd used before for stuff. So, and again, it's a melancholic song, you know, and actually, you know, does sound quite melancholic. I mean, it's as well. But so far from John Lennon, we've got Help, and You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. Mm. Again, if you combine the two, it's not particularly unambiguous.
He's just a ball of insecurities, isn't he? And I think at this time he was saying it was his fat Elvis period, wasn't it? And he was very aware. He was always paranoid about his weight. And I think during Help he looks awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'd read the kind of, you know, that was my fat Elvis period. And then when I rewatched Help as well, I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it at all. And, you know, I think that was more, as you say, a psychological insecurity than a physical one. I think
he had quite a few, didn't he, to be fair, bless him.
He did. Yes, he did.
You don't realise how much I need you. Love you all the time, I never leave you. Come on back to me. I'm lonely as can be. I need you.
Track 4. This is George Harrison's second ever released composition, I Need You.
Yeah, and, you know, this album has two George Harrison written songs on it, which was, you know, obviously a huge step forward from the one that he'd had up until this point. So he doubled his output on this one. And it's a plaintive song. It's quite nice. There's that weird, again, is it an organ that they've used on it?
The guitar. The wah.
Yeah.
It's like a pedal-controlled.
Right, the volume control pedal thing, which, again, was kind of new. I don't think they'd used that before. But also, for me, it was interesting that, you know, given that the two songs that George had written, I Need You and You Like Me Too Much, it's incredible to think for someone like George, who hadn't had that writing output, that within kind of the next 2 or 3 years, he was going to write some of the most memorable songs ever written. And so to that end, both these songs, they're kind of nice enough, but they feel quite simple. Mm. And especially when, you know, I think George Harrison and I think While My Guitar Gently Weeps or something, and Here Comes the Sun, which I think are, you know, extraordinary, extraordinary songs, lyrically and musically. These feel kind of like him feeling his way into kind of like, you know, being the person who takes the reins on the song.
Yeah. I think also there's not that much enthusiasm. If you listen to the backing on this, the sort of those... that's kind of the backing he's getting. So I don't know if they were that supportive for him. I mean, he's got two tracks on the album, but, you know, there's cases where Paul McCartney's doing guitar solos, and I think it was very much throwing him a bone. letting him into that.
Although, you know, this is the side of the album, and therefore this song does appear in the film. And actually, I kind of liked it more in the film.
Yeah.
For some reason. Yeah. I mean, they look like they're having fun recording it. Mm. And so if there was that disinterest from the others in terms of this being George's song, it's not evident when you see it performed.
No.
But I take your point, yeah.
Yeah, that's that great section in Salisbury Plain, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Freezing.
Yeah, you know, again, in Salisbury Plain, surrounded by kind of troops and tanks. It's just, it's
integral part of the plot.
Absolutely, yeah.
And again, this was recorded on the same day as Yes It Is, which appeared on the B-side of Ticket to Ride, which also has the wah-wah foot pedal thing.
Oh, okay.
So again, it's another thing that's lying around in the studio. You know, sorry to deflate any myths here. And again, another song to add to the list of songs written for Patty Boyd.
Yes, I mean, you know, there can't be many people who've inspired as many songs as Patty Boyd. I mean, that's, you know, George's ones and then Eric Clapton's. I mean, that's some muse, isn't it? I mean, you know, I think Cleopatra hasn't. I think Mona Lisa's only got one or two. One really famous one. Yeah. And it might be the odd one that's kind of, you know, mentions a wonky smile. But Patty Boyd, blimey. Patty Boyd, of course, also appears in Hard Day's Night, so which was only the year before. Yeah. It's that weird thing, actually, because you also go, apart from the stylistic changes in the songs, the fact they went from black and white to colour just makes it feel like it was several years later rather than the following year.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the hair had grown a bit. But that's the only thing that gives it away. So, yes, Patty Boyd inspires that. Another kind of good song.
For I have got another girl, another girl, making me say that I've got nobody but you. From today, well, I've got somebody that's new. I ain't no fool, and I don't take what I don't want, for I have got another girl.
Another girl. This is from actually from the first recording sessions. They started in February 65. And Paul's doing the lead guitar on this. And it's a very unusual bit of guitar solo work going on here. It's all over the place.
It is. I quite like it, I have to say. I mean, again, it's a pop filler, really. Mm. You know, it's not one of his classics. And I know that at this time, Paul, up until the writing of this album, certainly, his writing input had been a lot less than John's. You know, John had been writing a lot more. And Paul was obviously contributing to all of it, as he did. In terms of him driving the writing, had been a bit lax. So this does feel, again, it feels like, you know, something that would fit into the earlier poppy part of their careers, a part of the Beatles' output. I do like it. I do like it. Now, do you mind if I name drop?
Go for it.
So I had a conversation with Paul some years ago before a gig. I met him after the gig, a couple of months after the gig. And he'd said how nervous he was at the gig playing lead. And I said, I'm surprised, because I said, you've been doing that for a long time, haven't you? And he said, yeah, but he said, it was never an area of confidence for me.
Wow.
And so it was really interesting to hear that from him. His solos in the at his gig were brilliant. They were really, really good. And I said, "You've graduated to an axe man now."
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, well, thanks, you know." But he said, "Yeah, I'm always a bit nervous." So it's interesting that even in 1965, that he kind of obviously wanted to have a go, maybe that was the deal. Maybe they kind of said, "All right, George, you can have a couple of songs on here."
Yeah, contra deal.
If you just sit this one out.
You're gonna lose that girl.
Yes, yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
You're gonna lose
that girl.
If you don't take her out tonight, she's gonna change her mind.
She's gonna change her mind.
And I will take her out tonight, and I will treat her kind.
I'm gonna treat her kind.
You're gonna lose
Next up we have You're Gonna Lose That Girl. And I think this is Ringo's Freewheeling Bongos are the notes that I put by.
Yeah, that feels like it should be the title of something in it, in and of itself, shouldn't it? Ringo's Freewheeling Bongos. Yeah, it's again, it's another downbeat, melancholic song that I really like. And again, I think that for me, one of the reasons I can listen to the Beatles, you know, every single day is because even in, you know, the most mediocre sort of filler stuff, their vocals are always great, and the combination of the voices is just beautiful. And yeah, you know, it's and I think the same with this one. I think I like that kind of melancholy, and I like the fact that John sings it in a kind of melancholy way as well. And obviously, you know, Ringo's, go on,
Freewheeling Bongos. I love John's vocal on this. He's not afraid to go for the falsetto. And Paul, I guess, is more of the Little Richard falsetto guy. Mm. But when John hits falsetto, it's kind of like a yearning, it's a painful, painfully beautiful sound he gets from his voice.
Yeah, I agree. And it's that thing where it, you know, effectively goes up an octave to hit that falsetto. And that's really effective. I think, you know, any singer who can do that, there's a slight surprise to doing that, you know, and again, you know, the number of Beatles songs where they do that, and Elvis as well, live, actually did it more than he did it recorded. But there is always that little surprise that it's gone there. It's an unexpected note. Mm. And that works really well. I agree with you. I really like his vocals on this.
Yeah. Lyrically, he's effectively chastising his friend about mistreating his girl, but then ultimately concluding with, and I'm going to steal her from you. So it's okay. He's like, one minute he's caring for the welfare of this woman, but the next minute he's just going to steal her.
Well, does he say, you're the proper geek here. Does he say that if you don't treat her right, I will steal her? So yeah. Is it a warning, or is he saying, it doesn't really matter what you do, I'm going to nick her anyway? Because there is a subtle difference.
There is.
Or not so subtle difference between the two.
I suspect both.
He was a Beatle, he could do whatever he wanted.
We end side one with Ticket to Ride, which was oddly the first song to be recorded for the album.
This would, you know, probably make my kind of top 10? What am I talking about? Top 20 Beatles songs ever. I think it's just fantastic. And again, hints at that kind of experimentation, particularly with the percussion and the way it starts, is really unusual. They've not done that before. And what was interesting in the film was that it's a standalone lift out of the film pop video.
Yeah.
You know, complete with kind of notes appearing on the screen, you know, a stave and all that kind of stuff. Shot in Austria. And again, quite a melancholic song. You know, she's got a ticket ride and she doesn't care. She's going. She doesn't care about me.
Yeah.
But the images in the film are of them all having a good time.
Yeah.
They're rolling in the snow and punching kind of little, you know, snowmen that they've made and falling over. And I mean, I think it's a great pop video. I think it's a really great pop video. Mm. But it's, again, it's so at odds with what the song's trying to do.
Yeah.
And the melancholy of the song that it's just really strange. I mean, for me, you know, that combination of the clip from the film and the song works really well because I love the song and I love seeing them kind of just, you know, larking about without any kind of narrative to it.
Yeah.
And a bit like Can't Buy Me Love in A Hard Day's Night, where you've just got a lift out sequence of them running around in a park, you know, sort of doing piggy banks and falling over and just generally being silly. And it kind of worked really well, but that was quite an upbeat song. Whereas this, you know, the sentiment is quite down. But I really love it. I think it's such a great song. And it's one of the songs that I kind of remember from my I was going to say youth, but, you know, probably my toddler days. I don't know, what do you call your toddler days?
I don't know. Toddlistic? No.
Yes, toddlistic. Toddlistic martyrs. The toddle puddle martyrs.
Yeah.
There we go. Then, yeah. Then. So my toddler days. So yeah, when I was 3 or 4, I think, I was, I kind of vaguely remember it from them being played on the radio and stuff like that. So.
Yeah.
I've got a huge amount of affection for the song. I think it's a great song.
Jay Foreman, who was on before, mentioned that it's a drone. And this was around the time that the dentist spiked John and George's drinks with acid. So they'd had an acid experience. They were smoking a lot of pot. But Jay Foreman was saying you don't write a song with a drone without having experienced some sort of high. And it is, it's not been heard before.
Unless you're Indian.
Ah.
Indian music has drone in it as a very kind of fundamental part of it. So you, if you think about a lot of the songs that George wrote later, which had an Indian influence, there is a drone to that.
But if you're a 22-year-old rock and roller, I'm guessing...
No, you have to have dropped acid. Yeah.
It's the only way.
Yeah, it's the only way, yeah. Apparently. I mean, I never have. I never did when I was at university or when I was 22-year-old, so I've missed that moment. But then, you know, I had the Indian background, so I had the drone anyway.
You did.
Yeah.
And also, one thing I noticed, the drums on this are not dissimilar to Tomorrow Never Knows.
Which I really love. Oh. I love, love, love Tomorrow Never Knows. But yeah, you're right. It's got that similar sort of double fill. That just doesn't hit the kind of, it's not the 2-4 sound or the 4-4 timing thing.
Yeah.
It's something that fills within it, which again just makes it really interesting. And again, hints at that. I mean, it's like with Tomorrow Never Knows, they committed to it fully.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it does kind of break and follow a much more kind of pop structure.
Yeah.
But in a much more interesting way than they'd done before, I think.
Absolutely. I've heard lots of interviews with you, going back to your, what was it, Toddlistic Martyr?
Yeah.
Days, you had a pretty horrendous time, didn't you, as a kid? And you've come out with it with so much grace.
Well, well, it's very kind of you to say. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who had it much harder than me. I mean, it was, school was difficult. I mean, early school was all right at the time. I think that, you know, when you're really little, when I was 6-7 years old, and I think now back to things that I was excluded from, and I can, you know, you deconstruct it in a different light. You know, at the time I didn't know. So, you know, when there was the nativity plays, you know, the fact that I was patently, as has been borne out, a much better actor than anybody I was at school with. But, you know, I never got to play Joseph. I never got to kind of, you know, I was always shunted to the corner. I was a sheep for many years. Well, one of 3 wise men until I complained 4 years of having played all of the wise men plus the same one again. And then they kind of made me head sheep. And it took me 10 years to realise the irony of that particular statement. But, and I think, you know, there was that lack of imagination that went with it. And I remember... one of the school plays was Aladdin, and the boy who got to, I was understudy, and the boy who got to play Aladdin was chosen, I was told, because he had his own judo suit, which looked vaguely Eastern, which again I bought at the time, but even then at the age of 8 or 9, you know, in the rehearsals, when he couldn't get it, the teachers would say to me, can you go up and show him how to do it? I would do it, but then I would never get cast. So you kind of deconstruct that differently as an adult. At the time, it just was what it was.
Yeah, you don't notice.
Not really. And then, you know, secondary school had its challenges in a slightly different way in terms of racism generally was kind of much more on the surface, and it was more prevalent. And also, I got it from both sides. I got it from the Asian lot and from, you know, the white kids. And it was, you know, I value those experiences now. And maybe that's why I may appear to come across with more grace. Because I do see those as kind of seminal moments and ones that allowed me or forced me probably to to redefine myself in association and with regards to my environment and the people around me. So, you know, something as fundamental as who are your people, who do, you know, that phrase.
Your identity.
Your people, yeah, your identity, your community. All of that was something that I had to kind of break down and start again. And I think ultimately, long term, I think that's helped me and hasn't left me, you know, emotionally scarred. Or, but, you know, there were kids who were hugely emotionally scarred by their experiences at school and physically scarred in some cases. And so, you know, I'd never sort of placed my experiences alongside theirs. In, you know, they're the ones that I think, you know, perhaps need greater understanding or empathy. And that's most kids. Mm. You know, most kids will have a difficult time at some point. So, you know, the part of my sort of what I try to do is to kind of, you know, live each day with a degree of empathy and compassion. And so in that sense, my own is, you know, it was kind of interesting and weird and at times difficult, but, you know, I've come out of it all right.
Yeah,
you know.
Absolutely. You've got a very nice Beatles t-shirt as well, which...
Thank you very much. I've also got Beatles socks.
I didn't see those.
No, no, you weren't meant to see them. I only just stuck my leg in the air so you could. But
I mean, for me, you know, in the 70s I grew up and I was born out of wedlock. And I remember, again, I don't remember anything odd at the time, but looking back, I remember there was one particular teacher who was very Victorian and full of a young boy without a father. And I would always be sent out of the room for... You know, everybody else was messing about. I was clearly picked on by this woman. And, yeah, a lot of things like that, you look back and you think, yeah, that didn't actually affect me at the time, but looking back, that was pretty crap.
Yeah, that's horrible. That's horrible. But also, I think...
The 70s is one way of saying it.
I know, what a decade. Well, it was... But also, I think that when we think back, you know, the bullying or kind of whatever you get from the other kids... is kind of almost understandable. The bullying that you got from adults is what's really horrible. Yeah. Because I think that's the stuff that really cuts. Because, you know, the kids are just like that. And, you know, if you were of a particular personality, you know, you could hit another kid back, either verbally or physically. Adults, you couldn't. Adults had power. And so that, for me, is the most heinous kind of bullying, is the punching down thing. And particularly when it comes from adults, you know, in you know, whether it be, you know, parents, family members, teachers, or random strangers, that whole thing. A lot of the charity work I've ended up doing as I've got older has been linked to children, particularly, and women to a certain extent as well. And because I kind of remember, you know, and still remember, you know, my vivid memories go back to 2.5, 3 years old, so I can remember fairly clearly stuff from 3 onwards.
Wow.
Yeah, the earliest memory is 2.5, and then a fairly sort of anecdotal memory after that. And I kind of remember how, you know, how I was treated, but also how other kids were treated, and particularly how women were treated through the kind of 70s, was generally pretty appalling.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I don't think it's any surprise to me that I've ended up kind of, you know, working with UNICEF and various groups that sort of promote educating and empowering women and children. And so I think it comes from that. You remember the slights, you know, but you particularly remember them from the adults, I think. So that's a horrible thing you went through.
Yeah, there were some pretty crap teachers around in the 70s. But.
Well, I got banned from my music room. So when I was listening to Desert Island Discs not that long ago, and my friend Nitin Sawhney, who's a you know, phenomenal composer and musician, and he was talking about how he got banned from his music rooms. But the passion for music didn't stop him, and ultimately, you know, he's this most phenomenal musician I've ever met.
Didn't you used to be in a double act with him?
We did. That's we did. We did a comedy double act, which I remember. We thought there was nobody out there reflecting our experiences of being British and Asian, and so we said, "Well, why don't we do something?" And I said, "Well, that combination of music, particularly including music in it, will make us really unpredictable." And so it meant that we could do sketches, and then I could do a comic character, and then we could do a song, or Nitin would play a flamenco piece or something, or a blues piece. And it meant we were very difficult to pigeonhole. And the act that we had and the stuff we were doing then got noticed by BBC producers, and they were thinking of making a sketch show. And that's how, you know, a lot of the characters that I did then and Nitin and I were doing then could just got absorbed into Goodness Gracious Me, which is the sketch show, which kind of started my career.
Yeah.
But him saying that he was banned from the music rooms reminded me that I was as well. And
what did they say about, just you lad, you're not going in?
In my case, it was a teacher who came in. We had these little practice rooms, and they were empty, and I found one that was empty, and I used to go in there at lunch times and just pick out stuff on the piano. And he came in and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Oh, I was just playing on the piano." And he said, "Will you be doing music O-level?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." And he said, "Do you have a piano at home?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Get out, your band." And so that was it. And, you know, I mainly went in there, A, because I was passionate about music, but also because, you know, the school outside, you know, what was going on there was pretty shit. And so it was an escapism thing for me. And it still is. Music is still escapist for me.
Yeah.
Both playing it and little bits that I've composed for TV have been pure escapism for me. So
your one refuge you had, he was pulling that away from you.
Yeah. Yeah, again, didn't see it at the time, but, you know, looking back on it. He wasn't necessarily to know, but neither did he take the time to find out.
No.
And that's what's shit about it. It's not that he didn't know, because, you know, he couldn't know everything, but he couldn't be asked to find out. So, but, you know, again, it didn't stop me. It didn't stop me from... It may have fueled my creativity in some sort of way. Because when I went to university, I then bought a little keyboard and I used to come up with stuff on that. And then I shared a flat with Nitin, and he owed me money and he gave me his guitar instead. And then I bought a much bigger keyboard, a synth, that I was able to compose stuff on for Goodness Gracious Me.
Oh, wow.
And then just kind of bought more stuff. And then the last series of the Kumars, I did the theme tune for that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow. Get you.
Look at me.
So, yeah, so taking solace into music.
Take that, Mr. Viner.
Yeah. I was saying, Viner. I'm trying to think of a nickname now.
Too
late.
Yeah, it's all right. I wasn't going to mention his name at all, but I did.
Do you want me to cut it out?
No, I don't mind. I didn't say his first name. Fred. No, it wasn't. It wasn't Fred. It wasn't.
Yeah, taking solace into music. I'm guessing the Beatles might have had some sort of impact.
Yeah, they were.
Their refuge.
They were, but also they were, you know, my parents, who weren't interested in pop music at all, liked the Beatles. Mm. You know, that was the soundtrack to their early years in Britain. And so there was that crossover. I think early stuff for them, I think when we got onto the experimentation of the White Album, you kind of put Revolution Number 9 in front of my parents and they'd emigrate.
Yeah.
I think that, and also the things that they found positive about Britain. I mean, there was, you know, that joy in the Beatles' music, particularly the early stuff that captured everyone's imagination. It's unbridled joy. There's a kind of joy of life about it, you know, and that cuts through everything. And, you know, people in India, I remember relatives in India knew of the songs. Mm. And again, they worked because of that optimism within the music, even when the lyrics were perhaps more, downbeat.
Yeah.
The music and the vocals weren't, because, you know, you put those, particularly those three voices together, and no matter what you're singing, there's hope.
Yes.
And that was the thing. Ultimately, you know, joy is hope. And the thing is that even with a sad song, those three voices working in harmony was hope. And so I think for me, it's always been that retreat. And even now, you know, when I listen to the Beatles in my car or on my headphones or when I'm going to bed, it gives me a bit of hope. Mm. And it's a, and that's one of the most powerful things that any human being can have. Yeah. And the worst thing that you can take away from someone, you know. So in that sense, yeah, they were a comfort. And I absolutely listened to them, you know, through college and through university and beyond. I remember a really good friend of mine, actually, who was at a different university. I remember going to visit him. And at that point, this was in the 80s, mid-80s or so. And so the thing to be into then was kind of post-punk, sort of indie stuff. That's what you had to be into. And I remember he wrote me a letter saying, really great, looking forward to you coming. He said, probably best that you keep our Elvis and Beatles love to ourselves. You know, because it was at that stage where...
They were very unfashionable, weren't they?
Yeah, they were just seen as kind of, you know, as kind of granddad music, you know. And it's... I don't think musicians did. Because actually some of the stuff later on is quite hard to play. So musically, I think musicians always respected them. But they'd been popular. And so, you know, populism in any form wasn't kind of questioned. And so the fact that, you know, they were then rediscovered in a way... And continue to be, you know, through whether it be 8 days a week, Ron Howard's film, or going back the anthologies, and even yesterday that I'm in, is that there's a whole new generation that kind of hear their songs again and either find them or re-find them. Mm. So yeah, they were always a comfort and still are, and I still kind of and still blow me away. Not because, you know, comfort can be passive. But actually, it's a really active comfort because I still kind of listen to some of the songs and go, how the hell did you do that? How did you come up with that? Yeah. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And the, I've always maintained that the... I haven't heard anyone else say this, so I am going to claim it as mine. But they're the only band you ever hear grow up solely through their music.
Yes.
You know, from sort of Love Me Do and Please Please Me, where you can hear the exuberance of youth, to, you know, Sgt. Pepper, White Album, Abbey Road, where you kind of go, you've grown up. You're these kind of adults who are kind of looking to kind of forge a way in the world. You know? And that's extraordinary. There's no other band that you hear that do.
No, that's extraordinary. Thank you. That was, I really appreciate you sharing that.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make a film about a man that's sad and lonely. And all I gotta do is act naturally.
Moving over to side two, and talking of joy, here's Ringo. Very happy about his acting career with Act Naturally.
Yeah, this is a really odd one for me because, again, from what I've read, John and Paul had written a song for Ringo.
Yeah.
Gosh, I can't remember.
If You've Got Trouble.
If You've Got Trouble. And, you know, Ringo didn't like it and said no. And again, there was this notion that Ringo had to have a song on the album. And so he picked this old sort of, I think it was a late 50s,
Buck Owens, late 50s.
Buck Owens.
Yeah.
Well, there's a name that hasn't been bandied around a bit. And it's a, you know, it's a good enough song. It's fine. It feels like, you know, it's a kind of American country song. Mm. And, you know, slightly kind of coincidental, maybe, that Ringo sings, I Hope You're Gonna See Me in the Movies. And it's on an album of a film soundtrack, which is kind of odd. It's fun and kind of forgettable, and it's not neither. It's, you know, it's a filler.
Yeah. I think side two of the album, there are a few, it is the archetypal B side, I think, with some of these songs.
Apart from one, which we will get to.
Can't imagine which one that is. This, oddly enough, was the last cover version they ever recorded. Till they got to Let It Be and they were doing all the covers. after this.
Yeah, I think Maggie May, I think, was the was the only one they sort of put out.
I get high when I see you go by. My oh my, when you sigh, my inside just flies. Butterfly, why am I so shy when I'm beside you?
Track two, It's Only Love. And John always said he was embarrassed about this song, but it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's good. Again, it's not, you know, it's not up there, because I think that one of the things with the Beatles in terms of songwriting, and, you know, and again, I've always maintained that they are, as tunesmiths, for me, they're up there with Mozart, you know, and after them, maybe ABBA, who kind of just knew how to craft a tune, a melody. Yeah. And so when you kind of, you know, their own bar is raised so high that for any other pop group of that time, It's Only Love, I think, would be considered pretty good. I think for the Beatles, it's just, you know, middling, really. Mm. I read that thing about John being embarrassed about it and that maybe he'd written it for another artist or somebody else to record and end up having to do it himself. But again, to me, it just feels like, you know, part of their early output rather than something that's kind of foreshadowing what's to come. And as I said, you know, for me, that's what's most interesting in this album is that transition thing. You've got songs in there that absolutely could have come out a year or two before, and then you've got these songs that preempt what's coming up in the next kind of 2 or 3 years. Mm. And so, in that light, It's Only Love is, as you say, it's a B-side track.
Though you've gone away this morning, you'll be back again tonight, telling me there'll be no next time if I just don't treat you right. You'll never leave me and you know it's true, 'cause you like me too much and I like you.
Next we have George's second track on the album, You Like Me Too Much. And again, this is John on the Hohner electric piano.
Yeah, you know, I mean, of the two songs that George has got on this album, I prefer I Need You. Mm. And again, this just felt like him trying to find a way forward. And when you think about, you know, how much further he got within a couple of years, I think that was extraordinary. I think it's an odd sentiment.
Yes, yeah.
You like me too much and I like you. It's not the most powerful message that... It's never won someone over, I'd imagine.
No.
You know,
you wouldn't find it on a card.
Can you imagine how you got that? I like you like me too much, which is kind of, excuse me, I think it's bye. Yeah. I like you too, by the way. But it's that's why I think it's not a particularly confidently written song.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure it knows what it's trying to do. Whereas I think I Need You is much clearer in terms of its kind of own through line.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you're not going to leave me because you like me too much.
No.
Again, you know, on a card.
Best wishes.
Happy birthday. Yeah. You know, happy Valentine's Day. You're not going to leave me because you like me too much.
Yeah.
I like you. So here's to a life together.
Good luck with that one.
Yes.
But I guess as a songwriter, he was obviously surrounded by Lennon and McCartney, the greatest songwriters ever. And I'm wondering, if for those kind of lyrics, if he's watching them and they did it effortlessly, and he's maybe thinking, oh, all right, okay, well, you only have to do this much effort. But of course, they're transcending every other songwriter. It must be weird for him. It's a challenging thing being the third songwriter in the Beatles.
I would love to. I mean, you know, I can't think of many groups where, you know, all four members individually afterwards went on to have, you know, number ones. I mean, that, again, is extraordinary to me. And speaks of, you know, not just of their abilities, but also their ambitions and also the love that the audiences had for them. And George was the youngest. And so, you know, he was I mean, he was really young when he kind of joined them. I mean, ridiculously, stupidly young. 14?
Yeah, 14, 15.
Yeah, you know, which is, it's ridiculous, you know. My son's 13. I'm going to point that out to him, by the way. I'm always looking for ammunition. No, I'm always looking for ammunition. It was kind of, you know, the Mozart thing. You know,
when he was five,
I kind of went, you know, by your age, Mozart had kind of like written symphonies, but now I can go, by your age, George was in the Beatles.
Yeah. Harsh.
I know, but you know.
But fair.
Parenting. Parenting fails. But yeah, I think that, again, you know, given that he was surrounded by these two phenomenal songwriters, I mean, I'd love to have been, you know, a fly on the wall when John and Paul were handed or George played them a song because there must have been a bit of them going, well, we know we can do better than that.
Mm.
And so then you kind of go, okay, is this just to keep George happy? Is it to encourage him?
Yeah.
Is it to what's going on here? Because as I say, within a couple of years, George is writing songs that will stand the test of time, you know, and, you know, to the extent I remember Paul in an interview talking about, you know, when, they were thinking about releasing, and he said it was usually kind of one that, you know, either John and I had done, and then George came up with his song, Something.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was almost a kind of, we couldn't ignore it.
Yes. At the time, George was contracted under Northern Songs before he had his own Harris Songs publishing company. So perhaps the reason they're allowing him to do his own songs, because they'll get some royalties rather than if he did a cover version.
Oh, okay. Possibly. That's interesting.
Mm.
Whichever way, you know, it worked, it certainly worked in terms of moving George forward.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing, is the confidence thing. I mean, there was a documentary about the Eagles, and they kind of said that when they wrote their first song, they were touring with some big music star, country and western star, and showed him their first song and said, what do you think? Is it any good? And he said, no, it isn't, but it will be. And the question was, go and work at it, work at songwriting, work at it, work at it. And so obviously, you know, George did.
If you let me take your heart, I will prove to you we will never be apart if I'm part of you. Open up your eyes now, tell me what you see. It is no surprise now, what you see is me.
Tell me what you see. Some Latin American percussion going through this.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember how this goes now.
It is no surprise now, what you see is me.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Bigger than the okay, good. Yeah, I, you know, it's not one of my favourites, and I think that, again, for me, it's a B-side, and strictly a B-side. You'd never, you know, there's a reason why some of those songs haven't kind of ended up on Desert Island Discs, whereas so many of their songs have, you know. And and again, I think it's because the bar is just so high. You know, it's really high. I mean, it's like filmmakers, you know, it's, you know, Orson Welles made Citizen Kane, and, you know, it was such a sort of opus that that it was really difficult. That's what you're going to be judged by. So any of his films afterwards, some of which I think are very good.
Yes.
Kind of go, yeah, as good as Citizen Kane, is it?
No.
And so, you know, they had to deal with that as well.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me, and I want all the world to see we've met.
If we're talking about raising the bar, I've just seen a face, which was recorded amazingly during the same session as I'm Down and Yesterday.
I really like this. You know, it's, again, it's you. For me, you can hear that impact of the, you know, American folk scene at the time. For me, this could have easily been a song by Simon and Garfunkel.
Yes.
With the kind of, you know, lay, 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 lays in the middle of it, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly that folk scene which they'd encountered with Dylan the year before. And So I really like it. There's a weird guitar intro. It reminded me of like a speeded up version of Blackbird, beginning of Blackbird.
Yeah.
It's just that top and bottom strings of the guitar use thing, which Blackbird does at the beginning, going the opposite way. but it's, I really like it. And also because I think that the speed at which Paul sings it, again, is really interesting. And it's kind of, you know, it gives it an energy that might not have been there had it been slower. And also, when you've got a song of that speed, you have to commit to it. And so I think he does. So I really do like this song.
It's one of those, when you're a kid, it's a challenge to learn the words.
Yeah,
so you can sing this fast enough to join in. But the harmonies, it's very, very Simon Garfunkel, isn't it?
That's, it did, when I, again, listening to it more recently, that's what it reminded me of. It's kind of, or even... You know, the sort of stuff that Neil Diamond was writing for the Monkees, you know, albeit a few years later.
Yeah.
You know, I can imagine Mickey Dolan singing it.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. Yeah. Somebody get in touch with Mickey Dolan. We need to hear this.
Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
And then we come to track 6 on the back of a soundtrack album, Hidden Away.
B-side of a soundtrack album.
Yesterday.
Given that, you know, up until this point, you know, the last 20 songs or whatever that the Beatles had written had mostly come from John, and that Paul was kind of like, you know, hadn't found his kind of muse. He hadn't found that moment that would kick him on. And... You know, in order to counter that, as we've seen on this album, he was writing poppy songs that kind of were upbeat and more akin to the stuff they did before. Then comes Yesterday. And I think, apart from it being, you know, the most recorded song, the most covered song in history, and lends itself to a rather lovely film of the same name.
It does.
I don't know if I'd mentioned it before. It's such a departure. Because, again, Paul is, you know, Paul is up and positive and John is kind of dour and pessimistic.
Yeah.
And then you have something like Yesterday, which is an incredibly melancholic song, you know, coming from Paul.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure, you know, people listening to this podcast are well-versed in, you know, the origins of the song, that Paul just woke up with it and wasn't quite sure that someone else hadn't recorded it and... called it Scrambled Eggs. I Really Love Your Legs, I think, was a possible second line at one point. It's a stripped-down song. I think, again, you're the geek in the room, I think this was the first song where none of the other Beatles were involved at all.
Yeah.
And that's, again, you know, as an indicator of the way the Beatles are going to work in the future... That's really huge because, you know, over those next few albums, some of those seminal albums, we've got, you know, three of them at least working very separately from each other and in a lot of cases, increasing cases, not being in the room at the time when something's put together. And in a way this with, and I think it was George Martin's idea to have the string quartet.
Which
as
Paul
well.
Didn't really fancy it. I think George had to persuade Paul to eventually
I think Paul said he didn't want it to sound like Mantovani. But I think that then George then kind of allowed Paul to basically direct the string quartet in the way that he wanted.
Yeah.
And it is, it's kind of, in many ways, you know, it's almost become a cliche. And it was, you know, the song that I remember John mocking in interviews. There was that interview he did in New York.
Yeah.
Where he said, you know, we didn't want to go on and end up being on a stage. Yeah. Singing Yesterday. And I always thought that was, you know, I guess, I mean, I didn't know him, obviously, but, you know, typical of John to take a side swipe. Mm-hmm. And interesting and notable that he didn't choose one of his own songs.
No.
But picked on the one that Paul did completely on his own that was then covered by everyone from Sinatra to Elvis and beyond. And when I was doing the some of the press for Yesterday, somebody said to me about, asked me about, the Beatles, and you know, would their songs would their music stand up today? And I said, yes, it would. And I said, simply because if you think about the range of interpretation of their songs, everything from, you know, Elvis to Sinatra to, you know, the London Philharmonic to Indian instrumentation, to everyone has been able to interpret the music because the music is that good.
Yes.
You know, it lends itself to that. Whereas, you know, there's loads of other, you know, artists and bands that I like, but you would never get that range of people being able to cover your songs. And Yesterday sits at the pinnacle of it. You know, there's obviously something about the song that has appealed to the greatest number of artists wanting to sing it.
I think it's because it's so relatable, isn't it? I mean, Paul sounds so desolate and brokenhearted. And a lot of it's difficult to relate to a lot of early period Beatles songs unless you're a teenager, I guess. You can kind of hook into that tormented love song or whatever. But this is just, you know, everybody's felt that. Everybody's felt lost. Well,
yeah, but this goes back to my point about hearing them grow up. Is that, you know, those initially they were songs about, they were simple songs about, you know, I fancy a girl or this girl likes me or whatever. And then it was singing about other people, and it was kind of, so she's leaving home and she's like, well, is that later? That's later, isn't it? So, you know, that whole thing about telling stories then comes through that where, and I know in with some of the songs here with John's, he kind of said, so now I was talking about my emotions, as opposed to other people's emotions or generalized emotions about love and, you know, advancing someone or whatever. And suddenly this was that thing about them beginning to write about how they feel. And that's what dominates their later output, is about them singing about their core emotions. And so this one is kind of really striking for it being Paul, I think. You know, it's Paul singing about a very personal emotion. It's not a generalized, this is how the world feels, this is how you get over it, you know, I'm sad because she's left. It goes some way deeper than that. And again, it's sort of pre-references what's coming up in terms of the direction that his songwriting's going to go into. You know, it wasn't that much later that we had Eleanor Rigby, you know, which is... There's no saving grace in Eleanor Rigby. And even within Yesterday, there isn't a saving grace. There's a lot of their early songs are kind of sad, sad, sad. But you know what? It's going to be all right.
Yeah.
You know, and here it is just, do you know what? Today's awful.
Yeah.
And now I think about Yesterday, and that was amazing. And so that sense of loss that comes through it, I think is great, you know. And again, a reason why this ends up at the top of a lot of people's lists. And then...
And then we
as
end.
As a counterpoint.
Yeah. This is... is this then saying... it reminds me... Remember Mike Yarwood?
Yes.
Where he'd do the whole... Do all the impressions. Oh, I know.
And this is me.
The worst bit.
It really was. Kind of, mate, we knew it was you all along.
We did. We got it. But is this... It's almost like John, when they performed Yesterday live, and he came, oh, thanks, Ringo.
You know, what I've read about it is that... This was asked for, you know, the Americans kind of said, look, the album's too short, we need another song, and they basically had to do something. And so this feels very much like going back to the Hamburg days of kind of thrashing something out. And so, you know, I think on the, again, I quite like it, but it feels like it belongs, you know, three albums ago. But it's like rock and roll music, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's a freneticness to it that I quite like, which may just be them kind of just being a bit pissed off and wanting to get home.
Yeah.
And it may, but it feels like a release. There's this release of energy within it, not just John's vocals, but everything about it.
Yeah.
I mean, and also, you know, for all their experimentation over the next 4 years, you know, they all went back to rock and roll at some stage, you know, in their solo albums. They all went back to the stuff that kind of inspired them at the beginning. And the thing is that Dizzy Miss Lizzy, it feels like a rip-off of, you know, one of Little Richard's songs anyway. All those Good Golly Miss Molly. I mean, there were a whole load of songs like that.
Yeah.
And this just isn't as good a song as some of those. No. But, you know, when I listen to it now, I just kind of imagine that I'm in one of the beer kellers in Hamburg at 3 o'clock in the morning with them all kind of like,
I think, because you said it was Capitol Records that were, come on, we need two more songs. So they did a quick session where they recorded this and also Bad Boy. Which
was by the same singer, I think, wasn't it?
What's Larry Williams.
Yeah. They're both Larry Williams songs,
it is.
I think.
And Bad Boy, for me, is one of my favourite John Lennon vocals ever. That would have been an absolute blistering end.
Yes, it is better. Yeah, you're right.
And John's vocal, for me, that is his best vocal on any Beatles song.
On any Beatles song? Yeah. That's a...
contentious.
God, blimey. Again, I didn't know that was recorded at the same time as Dizzy Miss Lizzy, because it got that same freneticness that Dizzy Miss Lizzy has. But I think it's a better song. I think that you can do more with it vocally. The thing with Dizzy Miss Lizzy, there's a pitch at which it is just sung throughout. It's like a high-pitched, angry drone.
So,
it is interesting that they didn't use that. Do you know why?
I think they'd run out of songs, to be honest. I think they'd had If You've Got Troubles, and That Means a Lot could have been the only other ones they'd have the option to use. So probably that is the best of those, at least. But yeah, why they didn't go for Bad Boy, I have no idea.
I mean, it kind of works. It's an interesting place to put it after Yesterday. I feel like I've heard them do that kind of song so much better. I mean, you know, Bad Boys you just mentioned, but certainly the, you know, rock and roll music, I think, or even Twist and Shout has that kind of drive to it.
So Sanjeev, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate that. Overall, how would you sum this album up for you?
You know, apart from the Beatles kind of, you know, being an integral part of my life from being a toddler onwards to present day, here's the weird thing, and here's the weird thing about life and how unpredictable life can be. I had, you know, Beatles posters on my wall when I was 14, 15 and stuff like that. And at that point, 15, I had no idea that I was going to, you know, have a creative job for a living. I didn't know that at 30. And in fact, I didn't know that at 34 either. So, you know, I came into it very, very late. And here's the thing I find really weird is that, this feels weird as a sentence, but I've met three of the Beatles.
Wow.
I mean, that's bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah.
So John is the only person I never met.
Right.
Because obviously I was still kind of a kid when he was killed. But I did meet the other three. The first one I met was George.
Okay.
And a job that I had for a while was an arts council project. Right. And we were at the Royal Festival Hall in London on the South Bank. And John was, you know, obviously, George, sorry, was obviously very interested in all kinds of music, but Indian music particularly became his thing, and Ravi Shankar became, he became a disciple of, really, to learn the sitar. And you know, George devoted a lot of his time and energies towards kind of, you know, Hindu philosophy and all that kind of stuff. And in fact, it was something that irks my sister and I, is that my mum has got a picture of herself with Ravi Shankar and George Harrison. But anyway, back to my tale. So at the Royal Festival Hall, there was a musician from India who was touring called Srinivas, who was called Mandolin. He played mandolin. And George came to see it. And so I kind of saw him backstage because he went to see Srinivas, and I was helping out with setting up the sound and lights at the gig. And I thought, I have to speak to him. I mean, I was kind of like, you know, really, you know, nervous and all over the place. And I can remember walking towards him and trying to position myself so I could guess where he was going to walk and I could just happen to be in his way.
Yeah.
And in my head, as he got closer, I panicked. There was panic in my head. And I thought, I can't call him George. I don't know him well enough to call him George. And Mr. Harrison. Yeah, I could call him Mr. Harrison. He's a Beatle. Do I mention the Beatles? Do I not mention the Beatles? And by that moment, he was right next to me. And I said, Mr. Borge. And he kind of like just gave a wry smile and said, yeah, you're right, yeah, great. And walked on.
Mr. Borge.
Mr. Borge. I got Mr. and then Beatle and George. And it was just, anyway. So that was George.
Oh.
And then they kind of, you know, brushed up Magical Mystery Tour a few years back. They kind of, you know, digitally kind of enhanced it and stuff. And they had a screening in London, which I got invited to. And I ended up sitting behind Paul. So Paul came in and, you know, took his seat. It was right in front of me. I'd met him before by that stage. So he turned around and he said, oh, hello. And he kind of gave me a hug and I said hi. And he sat down. What was really interesting was in the musical numbers, particularly I remember with I Am the Walrus, which started, Paul, because I was watching Paul, really watching the film.
Watching his reactions.
Was he counted the song in, mimed the drums, and then mimed the bass what he was doing, which was so exciting to watch.
Yeah.
So exciting. Yeah. So, yeah, so I met Paul a few times, and I kind of, I remember saying to him at this thing once, I said, you know, I went to his gig, and I said, Paul, you were great. And he said, that's what I'm trained to do. And I said, yeah, but you 3 hours, and you never left the stage and stuff. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I used to do this show called The Kumars, and, you know, it was this chat show thing where there was a family, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he went, I know. And I said, well, I don't want to assume, Paul. And also, you stand on stage to kind of 25,000 people and say, I used to be in a little band called The Beatles. Yes. And we're all going, we know.
So
he's great. Paul's great. And this is going to get super name droppy, but we're good friends with Twiggy. Who's good friends with the Beatles. So she hung out with them in the 60s and stuff. And she's married to Lee Lawson, who's a fantastic actor, a really, really lovely guy as well. And at his birthday, there was Ringo. And so I ended up chatting to Ringo. And my son was really little. And I remember as I left, I said, Ringo, I said, my son's going to be thrilled that he's met the original voice of Thomas the Tank Engine. Mm. And he laughed and he said, tell him he's moved on to a new station.
Oh, good old Ringo.
So, yeah, extraordinarily from, you know, people that were so important to me personally in terms of the way I grew up and the comfort and the security and stuff they gave me. The fact that I kind of then ended up meeting three of them is kind of nothing short of miraculous.
It is.
It's, you know, if I ever want to sort of feel humbled about my journey, I think about that.
Brilliant.
Lucky bastard. There's not a Beatles album that I don't like. I think, as I said before, I think as a transition album from their earlier poppy stuff, which got them noticed all over the world, to them kind of being more experimental, particularly with the next two albums, with Rubber Soul and Revolver, which still, you know, again, chart that. It's like that Seven Ages of Beatles thing, you know, if they were kind of little kids at the beginning, just with the joy of life, then they become teenagers and it's all angst-driven, and then they start to kind of question life a bit more, and then they kind of, you know, grow up and go, what else is there? And then they're kind of musing on life by the end of it, you know, just looking forward and going, I have no idea. But so in that sense, this falls bang in the middle. This is bang in the middle of kind of, yeah, the poppy, yeah, it's great to be alive, isn't it? It's all good, isn't it? Being a Beatles, great, isn't it? Is it? And that to me is this album, you know. So I think it's a really interesting album. But you know, just even a quick glance at both the sides and you go, you know, for me, you know, Help, You're Gonna Lose That Girl, Ticket to Ride, and Yesterday, and you go, yeah, they're all classics, you know, they'll all end up on and have done on best ofs, you know, various kinds. So I think it's a cracking album. I really like it. It's nice to see a good old fashioned, you brought in a nice old fashioned
beautiful photo on the front, Robert sort of Freeman, as well, isn't it?
Proper LP, which is nice.
That's the thing I forgot to mention. The semaphore on the front.
Oh, yeah.
doesn't spell help.
No, it doesn't, does it?
It spells nudjv.
There you go.
N-U-J-V.
N-U-J-V. V. Yeah. Does that mean help in Finnish or something? Maybe it
could do
in sort of, you know, Aramaic or something.
Possibly,
like that.
Possibly, yeah. We'll have to Google that.
They made nice shapes, though.
They did. Sanjeev, thank you so much, and good luck with the movie.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And if you're listening to this 1 year down the line, I'm sure it's out by now on DVD and Blu-ray. If you listen to it now, go to the cinema and see it yesterday. Hey, 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 hey.